session number 10763, rule 8.
Commander Lucas, Reel 8.
Well, Vinner Harvey, when he saw me, I must say he was very decent about it. And he said, well, I do recognise that we've got this right at the very start of your tenure here. But you must realise, I remember him saying it somewhere, he said, you must realise, old cock, that we can't have any more of this. I said, well, that's quite all right, sir. I have no difficulty in agreeing with that. Well, anyway, when I got these squadrons, the squadron commanders together and talked to them, or the ones who remained, there were two of them then, the other one had been lost. And incidentally, one of the squadron commander's wife, I remember, was a filter officer in the operations room, which was terrible. She was terribly upset about it. Although she didn't know what the outcome was, whether he was a prisoner or anything, it was very, very difficult. When I said to these squadron commanders, well, look, we'll go off now and we'll do a wing exercise, we'll fly about. And, you know, the moment that I got up there with them, don't forget we'd had all that flying in Malta, and then I'd had the fighter leaders school, and then I'd had 616 squadron. I mean, I really was a pretty experienced guy by then. And I realized that, notwithstanding the fact that a lot of them were experienced pilots and all that, but I mean, the thing, there was really no cohesion about the wing, and it really had to be got hold of. Now, the first thing was that all the, and this actually historically is quite important, because for ever since the Battle of Britain, with one or two exceptions, the fighter squadrons in fighter command had been flying in line abreast, in line astern. Three, they'd go up in three fours in line astern. One, two, three, like that, all in line astern. And they, when they got out, when they got up over France, they would widen out, but they would remain in line astern with probably one or two people weaving over the top to see what was coming down. And that was all right for if you've got a great many aeroplanes and squadrons, and it was all right for the guys who were in front, but it was terrible. I'd flown this in 66 squadron, so I knew exactly what it was like. It was terrible for the people who were right at the back, blue 4 and yellow 4 and red 4, flying at the back, because they were the ones that used to get picked off, you know, by the one who now is coming up behind unseen or down out of the sun. And in Malta, or rather at Tangmere under Bader, they had developed this largely line abreast flying, fours in line abreast, finger fours as they were called, the shape of the fingers on one hand, and undoubtedly they had reduced the casualties enormously, because the principle of the thing was two aeroplanes in line abreast, the pilot of the right-hand one looking to the left and the pilot of the left-hand one looking to the right, and you could cover the whole sky, but it depended absolutely on reliance of one leader upon the other, one pilot upon the other. You couldn't have, that's why it was so essential in Malta. We had to make it clear to the Air Ministry, we couldn't have these green pilots being sent out, because I told you, fellows, if they were asked to send two people to Malta, they'd just send the two people they didn't want. And we had to stop it. And they were named, people were named by the Air Ministry in the end to go out there. And they were you were absolutely reliant. I mean, it became an amazing sort of operation of trust. That this chap, if you were flying here, this fellow was going to be looking all over to the right and would see everything that was coming over there. And you would be looking over there and you were responsible for seeing everything that was coming all over. Now, I wasn't in the Tangmere wing, but Stan Turner, as I told you, was in the wing with Bader, and brought that out to Malta, and he revamped the flying in Malta on line abreast. We even got it right almost up into four aeroplanes or two aeroplanes in line abreast, and that's it, rather than finger fours, because we had so few aeroplanes that if we hadn't flown that sort of thing, we should have been knocked off. If we'd been flying line astern in Malta with those few aeroplanes against those massive Germans and Italians, I mean, we should never have lived. And so I was absolutely wedded to this. Well, when I... I didn't require any convincing that this was the right thing to be flying. And particularly in a wing where they'd had casualties and had lost leaders and that, I felt very strongly that we, as soon as I saw it, we really had to revamp the whole thing. Now, it was very difficult. It was one of the most difficult things that I remember in all my operational experience in the Air Force in three tours, was to change the flying of this wing from line astern into line abreast. Because the flight commanders, it put a much greater premium on good leading than the easy line astern. If you could fly out in front there and tell the three guys behind you just to stay with you and so on, well, it's a piece of bloody cake. I mean, all you do is to go on and you do what you like, and you know these fellas got to look after themselves behind. And so when it became a question of changing these fellas over, the flight commanders and the squadron commanders, it was very difficult. I was surprised how difficult it was. I mean, in the Royal Air Force, the word of the wing leader with the squadron commanders went. I mean, if you ordered this, you were going to get it. But I could see there was real resistance to it, because they'd been flying it. These were experienced people, don't forget. And if they'd been flying it for quite a while, as they had in the 11 group, their attitude was, well, why the bloody hell should we be flying it in 12 group, which wasn't hitherto, at any rate. It hadn't been as difficult as 11 group, because there weren't so many aeroplanes on the other side until the Americans started up the daylight offensive and they moved these aeroplanes up to Holland. And I do not remember any period in my time where I had to really exert one's authority. And I said, after we'd had this first perhaps two wing practices, because it was quite a complicated, without going into a long rigmarole about it, it was quite a complicated way, being able to change over in the turns without letting one getting behind. I mean, if you just did a turn like this and this fella turned behind, he'd get miles behind and he'd get picked off. So what he had to do was to slip under the other one and remain in line abreast here. It did require a lot of disciplined flying to do it, but it was well worth it. And after the second wing practice that we did, I called the squadron commanders in, and the senior flight commander in the squadron 64, where they'd lost the CO. And I said, now look here, you fellows, you must understand that we're going to fly it this way. I mean, there is no question of my changing my mind. I'm absolutely resolved on this. We've done this in Malta. I know it's a very different type of flying, but we did it against all sorts of odds. We've had casualties here. We've got to stop this stuff. And you fellows have got to toe the line and do it. And they were marvellous afterwards. But they thought that if there was some doubt, you know, if there was an uncertain sound, et cetera, they would still be able to go back to this line abreast flying, line astern flying, which was easier, really, from the point of view of the leader. And of all the time, and anyway, we then got the thing right. We did have very good success with the wing, I must say. We had very few losses. We had poor aeroplanes. We had these Spitfire 5s with the clipped wings and these cropped, the crop supercharger, so that it had improved the performance of these Spitfire 5s up to about 12 or 14,000 feet, but above that they were useless. I mean, you couldn't. And the reason why they did that was because the Spitfire 5 and the Messerschmitt 109F were evenly matched, and on the whole one would much prefer to be in a Spitfire 5 than you would in a ME-109F. But then when the 190s came along, they outstripped the Spitfire 5s, and we had a terrible period for just a short time before the Spitfire 9s. Rolls-Royce got this Merlin 66 engine, which was a wonderful power unit with a two-stage blower in it. We had a very, very difficult time. But in order to be able to prolong the life of the Spitfire 5s, they cropped the blower, so you got this increased power up to about 12 or 14,000 feet, but above that they were no good. Now we, because of that, had to do the close escort. for these attacks on the targets in occupied territory in France and Belgium and Holland. And you had to go through the flak and all this sort of stuff, and it wasn't really very pleasant. But I you know, Johnny Johnson has always been a great friend of mine ever since those days, because we were always doing the close escort for these things and going through the flak, and Johnny Johnson was commanding the Kenly Wing with his Canadians and the Spitfire Nines. And he was a super wing leader, and of course he'd got these marvellous aeroplanes. And I could always see him. We used to do the briefings together, whether it was at Coleshill or whether we did it down in 11 Group. We used to move down to 11 Group very often, two or three times a week, to Tangmere or Biggin or Manston or one of these places. And we'd nearly always work with the Kenly Wing. And I used to do the briefing for our chaps, and then Johnny would do the briefing for his Canadians, which was a very sort of makeshift thing, and it was really sort of a question of follow me, you know, with him. And I can see him now sort of 8 or 10,000 feet above us, waiting for these blooming 109s and 190s to come down and have a go at us, and he'd pick them off like sparrows off a telegraph pole as they were starting to come down. Mark you, a few of them got through, but he was marvellous, and he finished up, as you know, with what, 38 destroyed, I think, which was a top scoring pilot on the Western Front, Royal Air Force, and it was remarkable. But anyway, I was there from July until the end of the year, just between Christmas and the New Year. I think right at the beginning of '44, I left, and because I can remember Vera Harvey. I mean, I'd got to know him very well by then, obviously, because the relationship between a squadron flight wing leader and a station commander was very close. It had to be, because he was responsible for the overall thing. The wing commander was responsible for the flying, and the squadrons were responsible for the squadron commanders responsible for the squadron. But he was over the top, and therefore the relationship between the wing commander flying and the station commander was very close. And if it wasn't close and it was difficult, then I think it must have been a very difficult operation for a wing leader. I don't know. I never had it, fortunately. I always had a good relationship. But I can remember, I think we'd had a Christmas dinner or something, and afterwards, just before it, and Vera said, I just tell you, it'll be announced at the dinner. He said, I'm being posted. I'm going to, on the planning staff of headquarters AEAF, and we shall have to get on with it, and I don't know who's taking... Oh, he said, yes, he did. He said, I think Arthur Donaldson is taking over from me, and he'll be here day after tomorrow or something. And I said, oh, well, dear me, so that's a shame, something. We've had a very good relationship, and although I know Group Captain Donaldson, I was with him at Ibsley. That's very nice to think that he's coming, but it'll be a shame to think that we're splitting up. Well, he said, we aren't, boy, because you're going, you old cocky. He said, you're going too. And he said, you're coming down to Stanmore. And I said, well, God damn it, so you know. I thought I might have another 2 or 3 months. No, he said, you've done enough and finished. Now, so that was the end of my second tour. Now, there's one thing in that which is actually historically important. He, Vera Harvey, was a very adult person. He was a worldly man. He had seen a lot of flying. He had been in civil aviation before the war in China. He was in the auxiliary air force before the war. And although his actual operational flying was relatively speaking very small, in fact I think it was only probably in France during the Battle of France, he really didn't do anything. He was older, of course. Well, he's over 80 now. He was 7 years older than I. And there was no reason why he should have flown operationally, but he was a worldly man. He was very observant, and he had a broad base. He painted on a broad canvas, and he was very perceptive, and he was objective, and he was absolutely right to take me off, because I was, to tell you the truth, I was getting exhausted. But you got to the sort of stage where you went on and on and on. I mean, I had done in Malta, before I finished there, I'd done a stupid thing. I mean, I'd been posted home, and I had 249, as you know. I'd been posted home, and the new squadron commander who was taking over, he wasn't in place. He'd been named, and I'd they said that I was going to be posted. And I went off and flew with the squadron, having been posted, which of course was a crazy thing to do, and I actually got hit, and I was terribly lucky. It was Friday the 13th of July 1942. I can remember Friday the 13th. I've always thought it was been my lucky day ever since. And I was hit high up, and I had to force land, but anyway, that's beside the point. But there was always this determination, you know, if you were sort of wedded to a squadron or to a wing, to go on and on and on. Now, he was quite right to take me off. I think that the majority of station commanders would have let me go on. They wouldn't have been so insistent. I mean, he never gave me a chance. He just simply said, "Oh, cock, you're going." You know, I never said, I did say to him, surely I could do another couple of months or something. And I mean, Douglas Bader, I know, with Lee Mallory, when he was leading the wing at Tangmere, Sailor Malam had the Biggin wing when Douglas had the Tangmere wing, and Sailor, who was a marvellous chap, he was a South African in the Royal Air Force before the war, short service commission, I think, and he led the Biggin wing. He was one of the first wing leaders, like Douglas was at Tangmere, and towards the about halfway through his sort of wing, what would have been his wing leadership, he felt that he was getting tired, and with tremendous courage, I think, he said to Lee Mallory, who was the AOC, he said, "Sir, I really feel that I should go off flying. I've had a basin full." Now, there weren't many people, I don't think, in my experience at any rate, who would have said that to an AOC, and Lee Mallory responded to it at once. He was very good. He said, "Sailor, absolutely, you come off, and don't you fly again." And he was quite right in doing that. He knew enough. Now, he immediately sent for Bader. Douglas told me this. I'm very few people know it. But he sent for Bader, and he said, "Douglas, look, Sailor is going off. He feels that he's really had enough, and he wants to feel now that someone else is taking on. And how do you feel? I think that you've had enough, too. You've been through with the Battle of Britain and Duxford and all this, and so on, and you've now had a long run." And Douglas said to him, "Well, sir, if I could just finish the season off, you know, it's rather like a sort of shooting season, say until September, if I could just see it through, see the season through, that's always the summer with the good operations, with the good weather," he said, "that would be fine." And Lee Mallory, I think, probably mistakenly, but Douglas was a tremendously insistent person, he mistakenly, I think, said, "All right, Douglas, well, you go on, but probably come September, that'll be enough." Now, Douglas was then shot down on the 9th of August, 1941. And I don't think that was anything to do with tiredness, but at the same time, you know, you take the pitcher to the well. Now, that brings me to this question of tours and length of tours. And I think, actually, historically, this is important, if I may say so, because, as you know, taking fighter command, it was a little different in bomber command, because they were doing actually a specific number of sorties, 30, and then, of course, with extenuating circumstances, they could be extended. But with fighter command, generally speaking, one was on for probably about a year, it might be a bit more. It depended very much on the circumstances that one was dealing with. And I can think now of a number of... I did three tours, which was considered to be probably more than enough. I mean, everyone was expected to do one. A fellow should probably do two. But, I mean, it wasn't a sort of compulsory thing to do two. If you were doing particularly well in some other job, as a staff job, and they wanted you, or if you were instructing a particularly good instructor or something, well, they'd let you go on doing it. But on the whole, the majority of people felt that, in fighter command, felt that two tours was a thing. Now, there were some at the other end of the scale who just went on and on and on, long after they should have been taken off. Now, I can think of people like Cocky Dundas, for instance. I can think of Duncan Smith. I can think of Brian Kinkham. These fellows just simply went on and on. It became flying. I hope I'm not being unfair to them, but flying became the sort of hard stuff for them. It was the heroin. And you became addicted to it. There's no doubt. I mean, that life of sort of living with squadrons. And if you were that kind of person, you probably weren't so affected by the strain of operational flying as others were. At least you probably didn't think that you were. And so you went on with these people, you were working with them. It was a tremendously close and intimate relationship between squadrons and flights and pilots in squadrons and so on, and it led to problems. But anyway, this was the fact. And then there were other people. The other lot were those who were off and who were really considered to have had their chips, but who were on a rest or doing something, and who went on and on and on bitching and badgering to try and get back to flying. Now, I have to say that I really did that with Lee Mallory myself, and I think, to be honest, I say now with the advantage of hindsight, I was mistaken to do it, because I'd had, you know, two pretty good goes. I was probably, to be honest, much more use on the staff than I was commanding a squadron, a mosquito squadron at the end, because there were plenty more people who could have done it just as well as I could, and if not better. But I had this sort of feeling that all my friends were in France, and they thought that I was sitting on my arse, and Stanmore there start saying, well, that guy, he could get off his arse and fly again or something. You know, you felt all that. And that's why I went on. But to tell you the truth, I within a matter of about, well, after I'd learnt to fly these mosquitoes at Bicester, and I was just about to go to France, I began not to feel very well again. And I knew that I'd have, but I'd got to the point then when, I mean, there was no way I could say to Basil Embry, look, I've made a mistake with this thing. I really think I've had a good basin full. I'm ready to go and do something completely different at night, for instance. It's a stupid thing. But at any rate, I know, and for quite a long time after the war, I really wasn't at all well, in either sort of physically or psychologically. It upset me very much, actually. All that business of flying at night was completely alien. All through the war I'd been flying either with 12 people or 24 people or 36 people, and then suddenly to be flying with a navigator sitting in a mosquito at night, you know, in and out of those blooming Ardennes, sort of supporting the Americans when Rundstedt was going through it. It was a very, very difficult thing. But anyhow, I mean, having set my hand to it, I had to do it. Now, there was one other person that I can remember who should never, and I think really that Lee Mallory should have simply stuck to his guns with me and said, look, yeah, that's finished, and I don't want this anymore at all, and I don't want you to go and see our Marshal Embry, and you're staying here on the staff, and if you go on a bit longer, etc., etc., with the staff here, we'll make you a group captain or something. I mean, that's the sort of thing he could have said to me perfectly well, and I think that would have been the right thing. Now, at any rate, I got my own way, and I wasn't sensible, and I did this. And I tell you this because historically the thing is probably important, because it's a first-hand experience. Now, the other thing was that chap Richard Hillary, and you will have read that Last Enemy, that book of his, which was brilliant. Now, Richard, as you know, was shot down. He was terribly badly burned in the B&B. And when he had recovered sufficiently of these terrible hands all burnt, and face and eyelids and all being grafted on and so on. It was awful. Archie McIndoe had done it for him. He was sent to fighter command just about the same time as I went to fighter command. When I was sent there, instead of going to be the PA to the Duke of Kent, I went to serve on Charlotte Douglas's staff and the Air Staff. And Richard was there, sent there as squadron leader tactics. Now, squadron leader tactics at fighter command, there was a wing commander tactics, squadron leader tactics, there were two in the tactics branch, and as such he could fly, he was allowed to fly Spitfires and things, and we used to keep it in the station flight at Northolt, and we used to drive down there to Northolt and fly, and he'd go and visit stations and wings and squadron. Well, that suited him all right. Well, after he'd done that, he was there all the time that I was there. I got to know Richard very well. I liked the guy, but some people didn't. He was a very cantankerous, argumentative fellow. But I felt that he'd had a fairly difficult time. Anyway, I made a point of trying to get on with him, and did get on with him, actually, very well. And he started to talk to me about going back to flying, and I said, now, look here, Richard, I mean, as an old mate of yours, I really think you would be misguided. Oh, he said, I'm determined to go back and fly again. I'd only had that short time before I was shot down. And I said, well, I think you'll find it very difficult to get the CNC's permission to do this, authority to do it. And he said, well, I'm going to go on trying, and I shall go on and on and on. So we left it at that. Well, anyhow, every time he saw Sholto Douglas, he used to say to him, "When are you going to let me go back to flying?" Now, I know that this was rubbing old Sholto up the wrong way. He thought that Richard Hillary had got a chip on his shoulder, which in some ways he had. He was an extraordinary chap. He wouldn't have written a book like that if he was an ordinary sort of equally, evenly balanced guy. And in the end, Sholto, to be honest, got absolutely brassed off with him and said, "All right, Richard, you can go, but you're not going to go back on today fighting," which is what Lee Mallory said to me in so many words. "But if you go back, you've got to go back onto night fighters." Well, now, I knew, when Richard told me that he'd got round to the CNC, I knew that he was going to have difficulty. He had these terrible hands which were all bent up like this, and I knew that he'd had difficulty with the undercarriage and two levers and things. But anyway, he was determined to do it with bow fighters and plenums and things. And anyhow, I never thought anything more of it. He went off, and I can remember we sat down last night there in the mess and sat down and had a drink and dinner, and I said, "Well, Richard, I really hope it'll be all right. But all I say to you is that if you feel you can't do this when you really get at it, you really ought to say, because no one is going to, after what you've been through, no one's going to say. And anyhow, you've done this super book and you want to do another." It had been published then. And anyhow, he went off. And he went off to an OTU up at Charter Hall, or one of those North Country, Northumberland night OTUs. It could have been Accrington, but I think it was Charter Hall. Anyway, it was the Night Fighter OTU up there in Northumberland. And I never thought anything of it. And I was then posted off eventually to this fighter leader school down there in Chedworth. And I can remember so well, I went home for just a few days between leaving Bentley Priory and going to Chedworth and this fighter leader school. And I went home to my mother, stayed in Hertfordshire, my sister, and had two or three days there. And then I came back and had to gather my things up in that junior mess. We had a senior and junior mess, and the wing commanders and squadron leaders were in the junior mess, and the group captains above in the other. And this junior mess was the Cedars, which had belonged to the McLean toothpaste family before the war, and that's where we were, and where Richard had been before he was sent off up to the OTU. And I walked in there, I'd driven over, and I was just going to collect my things and go down to Gloucestershire that evening. And I walked into the mess, and the bell in the hall was ringing. And I picked it up, and I said, "It's a Cedars mess here." And a voice the other end said, there was a pause, and a voice the other end said, "Is that you, laddie?" And I said, "Yes, who's that?" And he said, "It's Richard here." I said, "Good God, Richard, what are you..." Well, he said, "I was trying to speak to so-and-so, but how are you? Well, you know..." And then he went through it all. And I said, "And how are you getting on?" "Well," he said, "getting on, I suppose, is about as far as it goes." He said, "I don't find it at all easy with..."